Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
So we're right in the middle of the Rugby World Cup. Well, maybe more like a third of the way in, And as you can imagine, there's a lot to talk about in terms of the Rugby World Cup. For those of you listening to our last podcast, we were talking a little bit about some of the injury prevention and the player safety issues and some of the technology involved at the Rugby World Cup, which was looking after the players, which Ross kind of explained. So lots to talk about. And today we have a very special guest with us, which we'll introduce to you very shortly, who is probably literally at the coalface of what happens on the rugby field. And we decided that we would pull this particular guest out of the rugby space and get him to answer all the questions that not only I have, but I think lots of people want to know about rugby. And I know Ross is going to ask answer some of those questions as well, and also ask some questions. So we're looking forward to that discussion. But before we get that underway, we have some updates. The last time we did a podcast, we talked about the doping case of Halep. And there's been some movement on that, isn't there? Final decision.
Yeah, so we did that recording on the Thursday. Mm. And I think literally as we were recording, they released the full decision, unknown to us. We were talking about it at what was actually quite a superficial level, not having seen that full decision.
Yeah.
And it was one of those where I realized we were initially just introducing, oh, by the way, here's a fairly high-profile athlete, not a cyclist or a track and field runner, which is in itself unusual, who got a doping ban. And then all of a sudden the discussion goes into like a lot more technical detail than I was prepared for, which I think often happens. So I thought, crikey, I better go and read this thing. And then I saw it came out, and I spent some time yesterday evening, one eye on the France-Uruguay rugby match and the other one on this document. And I have to say, and I've only made it halfway through. I've read, because remember, she's got two doping charges over her. The one is they found a banned drug in a urine sample that she provided at the US Open in August 2022. And then secondly, they've got biological passport numbers that look suspicious. And so it's two things she has to account for. I'm only halfway through, but I have to say, I really thought her case would be much stronger than what I'm seeing in this document. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I realize I'm reading a decision that was written after the decision was known. So they're telling a story based on an outcome, but nothing in her Roxadustat defense it makes me think that she would even have a chance at CAS.
To praise it, what would you say was the defense?
Remember when we spoke in the last podcast, we said that her claim was that she'd taken a supplement that had been contaminated. And so that's really the argument around this Roxadustat claim. And it gets, as always with these things, they're quite fascinating because they take you down paths that you wouldn't have thought even existed. The experts debate something called photoisomerization of the sample between the A and the B, which explains why the levels were different. And it's like these are proper rabbit holes. But the fundamental point is that she thinks it's the supplement, but a few things pop up. Number one is, when she gives her doping control form in at the time of the test, she doesn't declare the supplement. Now, in her testimony, she's only started using that supplement literally that week. So that's your first problem, because we know from the news that the biological passport stuff spans a lot longer than a week. So she's only got a contamination defense that covers a very narrow window within a bigger timeline. Makes sense? So that's a flag. Then she didn't mention it, not only in the doping form, but in an interview that was done in October after she'd been told about the positive sample. So this is going to be the thing she's going to blame for her positive test. And she twice fails to mention it. So that's weird. Then she says she's never heard of it. And then in another point in the testimony, she says she'd never take Roxadustat because she was due to go in for surgery the week after and she knows that it could be a side effects. Well, if you'd never heard of it, then how are you making decisions like that? Mm-hmm. And they literally catch all these things. They mention them in the document. It makes for a really interesting reading. It's a bit heavy, but it's quite interesting.
You're going to put that in the show notes?
Yeah, I'll put the link. I think I just sent a patron link out. So the patrons who are listening to this will already have it in your weekly newsletter, but we'll put it in the show notes today as well.
That'd be interesting.
But then the main thing is, And it comes down to that same issue on concentration, is she sends this supplement off to her experts, but also the authorities have their experts test the same supplement. They cannot find it in that stuff. Her expert finds it, but at such low concentrations. And then in the decision, you'll see they go into like the two experts, a guy called Alvarez and someone called Eichner. So Alvarez is Halep's expert, one of many, and Eichner's the ITIA expert. And they have this basically debate. And Eichner can't find this thing, this drug, in the supplement, no matter what testing method he uses. And he goes through different ways of approaching it. Alvarez, on the other hand, finds it, but at such low concentrations that it can't possibly explain the level in her urine. And they even do a control study where they get someone of similar size and build to Halep, admittedly a 58-year-old woman. And if you want to go look at it, it's 0.165 describes it. For me, the most interesting part of the roxadustat part is they give a 58-year-old woman the same supplement that Halep used, the same batch. So in other words, she's now taking the supplement. And she takes it for at exactly the same amounts and same times that Halep says she took it at. And then they do 35 samples over the course of a week. They only find roxadustat in her urine 7 times out of 35. 28 of them are nothing. Wow. And on the 7 that they find it, the levels are so low. Like literally, in OET 0.168 is, after adjustment for specific gravity, the values in the player's urine were 46 and 85 times higher than the highest value found on testing the volunteer's urine. That's the highest value. That's only 7 out of 35 samples. Mm. All the others were even more like different compared to Halep's. So that's Halep's defense, and it actually ends up arguing against her. So that's why I say when I think her defense is weak, she offers very little compelling, and her best claim actually ends up being used against her. So she can go to CAS. And I haven't even touched the biological pathway.
She indicated
stuff.
She's going to get a CAS.
Yeah, very vocally. She put out a statement on social media.
She just cut her losses a little bit.
It feels like. And her coach, a guy, Mortaglu, has come out and said he's absolutely stunned having sat through the hearing. And I'd read all that before I read this. And so I honestly read this document thinking I was going to see some real conflicts and tensions. It seems very clean to me.
And even Williams was saying in one of her tweets, she said, well, 80 is better because it was Simona Halep that denied her one of her Grand Slams. So
I'd be cautious if I were Williams, having had the same coach.
Yeah, Serena Williams, Halep. Yeah, sorry, I forgot her name there for a minute.
And the other thing about it was that Halep, in the verdict, and this is a bit further down, they talk about how the suspicious sample started in March, and Halep had started with this coach just in literally a week before the first suspicious sample was found. That same coach was Williams' coach. So okay. As Williams, I'd be a little bit cautious about that. Maybe like given the history of the panic room and the...
I mean, she is arguably the highest profile tennis player to ever be banned from tennis because of it.
Yeah,
I can't
think
of any
other ones. Like there's a cocaine one. Remember the gas gay or something. That's like trivial stuff.
A legitimate doping case. I actually can't... think of anybody that's higher profile
and
than
then,
it.
And then speaking of the other crazy thing in the case is her expert Alvarez says at one point, and I wish I could read it to you, is that there'd be no benefit to a tennis player taking roxadustat because it's not an endurance activity and so you don't need red blood cell and oxygen carrying capacity. And then, of course, the tennis authorities find an expert to say, of course you do. Just because you're not running a marathon doesn't mean there's not a benefit. I mean, they're doing 10, 14 hours a week. Of course, recovery and endurance make a difference. So, I don't know, the expert almost discredited himself saying that. Mm-hmm. And she can take it to CAS, but I didn't see anything in this decision that makes me go, oh, wow, she's done a dirty by the authorities here. Mm-hmm. So, I just thought to bring that up, you know. And then, that was, so I'll share that again. The patrons sent a few links out and there'll be some discussion on there for those who want to check it out.
Yeah. Right. So let's move on to the topic or the interview we've got today. So our interview guest today is a gentleman by the name of John Dobson. They're very well known, particularly here in the Western Cape and in South Africa, as one of our leading coaches and the coach of the Stormers franchise here in South Africa. And of course, one of our most successful franchises in South Africa. A real technician of the game, a man who really understands the game. He's got some fascinating sidelines, which Ross, I'm sure you'll be able to explain a bit of those as well. But we decided that we wanted to get a couple of the questions asked. And I think
a lot of it came from me because I would describe myself as a rugby fan, but not a rugby expert. And there's lots of things that I've always wanted to ask somebody who really understands the game really well about the intricacies of the game, particularly with the World Cup at the moment. That's why I thought, well, we were chatting a little bit about who could be the best person to do that. And John is a very eloquent and a very intelligent coach who really understands the game. And I think he's going to be a great guest for us today.
Yeah. He's an extremely creative guy. I've known him for many years because he coached at the University of Cape Town in our local Varsity Cup very successfully. He was part of transforming that whole setup. And so he's clearly been on this pathway up, and then now Stormers coach and a championship winner in the URC. Mm-hmm. He also sits on a couple of rugby, World Rugby working groups, for instance, on the calibration of the high tackle framework and processes, where we have a group of refs and coaches and so on. And he always adds like really, really interesting, I think, technical insights. And he has a creative way of looking at the game that many coaches don't. Not many coaches can claim to be book authors.
Yes, exactly.
Not a rugby book either.
Yes, exactly. So he's an author of children's books, isn't he?
Yeah, amongst, a couple, and probably a little while back now. We might ask him about them. but he wrote a couple. I gather he hasn't continued the franchise. Maybe rugby takes more time than that now. But yeah, an interesting and insightful guy, and we hope that he gives you some insights that open up the rugby watching experience over the course of the next, 4 weeks to go in the World Cup.
Well, given his history and his success with the Stormers, I mean, do you think it's a possibility he could be the Springbok coach at some point? I mean, he must be in with a chance, I would think.
Yeah, on merit, of course, but we know these jobs aren't always...
Not always
a straight path. Even when you connect one successful dot to another to get to that place, there needs to be a few things go your way. That's global, actually. It's not even unique to here. So who knows? I wonder what his ambitions are, actually. Never even thought to consider that. What's the pathway? There's one job, you know, and there are 10 coaches competing for that one job at any given time. So what do the other 9 think they're going to do next? Yeah. Interesting to ask that.
We haven't interviewed him yet, so normally what we do is we do our intros after we've spoken to the particular guest, but today we are waiting for him to arrive, and once he arrives, then we'll be introducing him. But yes, here is our interview with John Dobson.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
We had a bit of a cold.
Yeah, I was fine.
Yeah,
it's
good.
This will be okay.
Huskier than usual. Mike's got sound magic. We'll add some treble or whatever it takes.
No, I've subscribed to this thing. I'm trying to think of the first guest when it was a couple of years ago. Flip, who was your first?
We've been going for 2 years. Yeah, this is our 5th season.
Okay.
Actually, and it's been pretty cool. We've had Gary. We had Gary Kirsten on once. We had Henry Mallett on the odd occasion.
I was trying to think what the first one that gripped me into it. But
it'd be interesting to hear what you thought was the most interesting one that you've listened to, actually.
I just can't remember.
You're interested more. It's not necessarily always about rugby, is it?
No, so I wouldn't do like the running stuff for that, or the team stuff and the team coaches.
Yeah.
You
can learn. Yeah. I suppose there's an idea that we can always cross-pollinate between, you can always learn from other sports with learning about other sports.
Oh, definitely. Like, I don't look at the individual. I'm just thinking I've got it here. I can save some of them.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm interested in the team stuff. But I've been a subscriber for 2 years. So there's a thing.
Well, now we know what you do in your spare time. I thought you just watch rugby matches 24/7.
Podcasts, the amazing stuff around team. You know, I don't listen to the rugby pods because actually not much good in rugby.
There's not.
No.
Yeah.
But the some of that stuff in America about team building and culture. There's a trying to think of the best.
Yeah. Now you can learn a lot from those sort of sports I mentioned. Always do I find that the American sports are quite very different to
very different
what we see in Europe and South Africa and the way that they deal with stuff. Like,
there's some you know, Daniel Coyle's good. That stuff around, that building and belonging. Yeah. Owen Eastwood's popular now. You know, the guy who wrote that. So he didn't write, it's about belonging. I can't remember which book. He wrote a book called Belonging by James Kerr and all that stuff about, that's really good.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think which is,
why are you looking for that? How many books have you written? Kids? Just two. I thought you'd written more than that.
No, I wrote a third, but I don't want to publish it now.
is it also in the kids' genre?
Yeah. That was Gary. It was my first one, which was Gary, in 2018.
Yeah,
that's 5 years.
Yeah, that's five years ago. We've been going for a while, actually. And some of them do really well, and some of them are more sort of like pitched at a wider market. And that's kind of what we want to do today, because we want to sort of, we could get into the weeds and the technical side of rugby, but we can also get into like some of the questions that Flo, I was saying to Ross when we did the intro for you. When I think about rugby, I think about, I'm a fan, but I'm not an expert. So I said to Ross, I want to ask you some questions about stuff that I look at the game and I think, what happened there kind of thing. So, and also questions from people that listen to the podcast and people on Patreon that support us. We've got some questions from them. So the questions we sent you and which we're going to get into are about that and kind of just answering those sort of questions. So hopefully you can answer
them. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Because I've got no doubt, you're right. People watching this World Cup now, I think, what's that? Why do they do that?
Exactly. Anyway,
he's the guru in world rugby at the moment.
some elements of it is.
Some parts, yeah. I reckon a lot of people watch rugby and they go, what the hell? That's not right. Is there another sport that eats itself like rugby fans eat rugby?
It's crazy.
Yeah. Mad, eh?
What do you mean by eats itself?
Like they'll watch a great game, like tremendous actions, even like last night, you know?
Mm.
Uruguay pushed France in the opening game, tremendous. But the only thing that the conversation then is about the three things that I saw that were wrong. And then they play whataboutry.
Mm.
And then you'll have this person post a picture of this and say, I see that and I'll raise you this one. And it's like, you know
what I mean? Crazy about rugby.
Maybe other sports do it too. I don't know. But it just feels like the fans are intent on undermining the sport. And the English media, all they write is articles about the death of rugby and how it can't afford this and so on, you know?
Yeah. Anyway, let's get into it. I mean, we are recording and we've been recording since you walked through the door. So it's, we might have to take out some of the stuff you've said, but we'll keep it. I'm going to kick off with something quite basic. And I think it's a kind of question that I can ask both you and Ross. Like, one of the things that I said to my wife the other day, what would you like to ask about rugby? She goes, what goes on with their ears? Why do the guys always end up with those weird cauliflower ears? So maybe you can tell us what happens that causes that. And maybe Ross can kind of explain some of the physiology.
Ross will know the physiology and the science better. But the two locks are pretty much always taped because of the chafe, because they're between the two hip bones.
Mm.
So they get those, I don't know why it happens so quickly, Ross. Why? But they get these, just the chafing flattens the ear out, this bit out here. So there's some guys who are definitely strapping for aesthetics. So I played hooker. I'm not sure in a hooker position we'd get quite the same level. The two locks I can see crystal clear.
Actually, the ear is actually on the hip bone, so it's a hard
between,
part of the body.
Between two hip, between the hookers and the one prop's hip bone. So that was the generator. That was the start of cauliflower. Yeah, the number eight's also got a case for it.
Yeah.
You know, whether a seven flank, I'm not sure. Hooker, I played hooker, I'm not sure. A lucid, it's theoretically the same reason. I think some of it is aesthetics. The only reason for it is the cauliflower ear, to protect your ears.
So you're saying when the aesthetic, the taping of the ears, yes.
Taping. And I'm not sure hooker needs to. Mm. A seven flank, an open side, he's got one side, and it's not really a high-pressure side, he's more with his shoulder. So some of them like it, and some of them will fuss over the colour of tape.
Mm.
You know, the colour of tape's a big thing.
Why? Was it like a lucky thing?
No, they all do. You watch the Stormers all wear dark blue. The Bulls will have a light blue tape. The Lions guys will wear in South Africa red tape.
So they want to feel aesthetically compatible with the rest of the team.
Yeah, I think that's locks. Look, they do the strapping, which we might come to later, but they'll wear the reinforcement will be the insulation tape, the colour of the jersey, generally. The these guys, everybody's got a sore wrist because everybody's wearing wristbands now.
Yeah.
With the colour around it.
And you're allowed one slogan or word or something written on it. Yeah. There's actually a law on that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've seen that. So what are those slogans? Is it like the wife's name?
Sometimes it's a Bible verse. Sometimes it's a saying or a motto or something like that. And in actual fact, they check it. And if you've got more than that, they make you change the strapping.
Really?
Yeah. It happened while I was now in the World Cup. In fact, one of the medical doctors had to change his strapping because even the medical doctor at it, and they said you got too many words on your.
some of the flowers, like Marnie, will have his first four or five players on the inside, and then there's a family or a cross or something on the outside.
Yeah.
I mean, the strapping wrist is ridiculous. I mean,
but why are you saying it's ridiculous? Because you don't need it, or
there's
no
medical. I mean, they're doing just like you're there, Ross, one band of elastoplast.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a purely aesthetic or a messaging thing.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Okay.
I don't know about the cauliflower ears, Ross, and the physiology, but Alan Jones and Kitsy don't strap their heads, but they would put that
tape,
put a micropore over it.
Yeah.
So they don't imagine it's genuine. You know, Kitsy's doing it on his right ear, which is right because he's a loose head, so his left ear is clear.
Yeah.
Very rarely makes it to the final whistle.
When you say that it happened, when you say it makes it happen, it comes quite quickly. When you get players at the level that you're coaching now, have they already got those malformed ears, or were they getting it at school level, or does it only sort of come through in the elite level?
Some guys are prone to them. Okay. I mean, there's some guys, I'm trying to think of a guy recently, I just can't think, they would have to get them drained before the games.
Really?
So look, at school level you'll get some. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure, so it's quite a serious thing. I mean, we almost make a bit of a joke about it, but actually it can, as you say.
No, it's pretty hell of a painful.
Really? Yeah.
And you see the guy literally drained,
Yeah, sometimes you have to get it drained because it's caused by, it's a hematoma. It's like an infusion of blood into the space caused by damage to the blood vessels.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically bruising in that around the cartilage, and then it almost clots, and then it blocks access of nutrients to the cartilage, and then the cartilage dies.
Mm.
And then as it tries to reform, it's chaotic and it doesn't reform in the same shape that it should. And that's why it ends up looking like cauliflower.
Yeah.
I mean, but if that hematoma block's large enough, then it has to be drained quite quickly. It's necessary.
So is it fair to say that the old school players didn't care about strapping and therefore that's why you see a lot of the older players? It's more current that the guys try and strap the ears so they don't suffer.
I think the ear strapping's been, since I was playing with the guys, the locks were strapping.
Mm.
So I think it's quite old. I think cauliflower has been an old problem, hasn't it?
Yeah, so, I mean, you see it in guys, like even the guys who played in the 70s, 60s, 70s, you can see them with cauliflower. Yes,
there were some weird contraptions as well. It looked like there's, you know, death row, you know, when the guys go to the electric chair. They used to wear some of that stuff. The old-fashioned scrum cap, remember?
Yes.
With the laces hanging down here.
Scrum caps would also achieve the same thing. Mm. Part of it's putting your ears back so that there's less chance of them rubbing and bumping things.
Yes.
Because it's trauma. So sometimes you see it in boxers, like MMA fighters also get them. Yeah. Sure. Not as frequently because it's not – but it's friction and trauma, blunt trauma and friction.
Yeah.
Mm.
Sure, that's an interesting. I learned a lot about that. I thought that was quite a simple question. And then, I mean, just moving on from the strapping thing. So, one of the questions we get is that why do players have strapping on their legs on their thighs?
The locks you were talking about.
A lot of the players have strapping on their thighs. Is it only those locks that are getting that?
It's just the jumpers.
Mm. Okay.
And so we always look to see who's strapped. Like you'll never see Dion Ferry with that because so they put a piece of from a yoga mat. In the front here. I don't know why. I think it's uncomfortable. They don't do it at the back. So you'll see it's literally a piece of rubber about, you know, probably like 2 or 3 inches longer on the front. So if you're lifting from the front, you can get that. I'm sorry, it's a podcast, it's hard to show. But the lifters will have to grip just underneath that.
So it's a hold, basically.
Yeah, it's a hold.
It's a hold, yeah.
And the back, they used to, but the players, they don't like it on their hamstrings.
Mm.
So the back, they tend to just get below the sort of bum cheeks, and throw you up from there. That's the grip on the back.
Yeah.
This is the grip on the front.
Mm.
So that is, I would say, is necessary.
Mm.
But the guys almost take a bit of pride in it as well. You know, they think it looks cool, but it is only the jumpers.
Yeah.
Speaking of lifting in the line out, you got to, lock 6'5", 190, 2 meters, let's say, 2 meters tall, weighs 115. If you took a 6 foot back who weighed 100, could you not lift him higher and faster? And have you ever thought about putting a back as your lifted player in a lineout instead of a heavy lock?
You're right on both. You're right. You can get them lighter, but we've never thought of it. We've never done it.
Mm.
It actually tends not to be so much your point is valid, but it didn't have to be so much about height. Now, the jumpers are more timing. Timing and trying to get there. Because they, you know, seven-man lineup, they can put up two pots. We theoretically can put up three, if you know what I mean. So we both 7-on-7, so, but they would have to pre-decide who's going up to have two lifters. Whereas, we, you know, we could have almost four pods if you're just clever with who's jumping. So and the timing. So you shouldn't really be in a contested ball. And it generally tends to be, if it's contested ball, you're generally going to lose it. Because they've chosen a spot and they're going as high as they can. You've tended to have a bit of movement before. His theory's right though. A back would be easy.
But the lifting, when I think about lifting, I think about it's only in the line out. So we asked you talking about when kickoffs.
Okay. Yeah. It's a big part of the game.
Okay. Just so you can get elevation, so you get position.
There's an overload on those locks, the tight forwards nine rugby, which is worrying me. But so they're going to more for 20 or 30 seconds. They've got the scrums, which we all know how pressure those have become. And then now they're going to receive the kickoffs, which actually become, I think we have more kickoff. If you're scoring well, you're going to have more kickoff receipts than you are going to have in your own scrum. So they're basically a full-blown set piece now. And then they're going to have to do all that cleaning and carrying between the two 15s. It's really overloaded against the big fat guys at the moment.
Okay. Well, I mean, let's have a look at the scrum, because this is an area which I really struggle with. Because
a lot of people do.
You're trying to solve the world rugby, aren't you?
To some extent. No, I'm passing the buck on that one. That's the refs.
When I look at a scrum, and suddenly the scrum collapses, and then everybody jumps up, and there's a massive celebration, and then the box upstairs is going like, "Woohoo, we did that." What am I looking for to try and figure out whether that team has won the scrum? In other words, when a scrum collapses, how do we know who's won?
The ref. The ref gives a penalty to one team.
You as a coach, you'll say, "Oh, Storm has won that scrum." What are we looking for to see that?
The easiest one, the only one I understand is the dominance. Now, whether that's right or wrong is a debate, because what's wrong with being stuffed up? You know, if I carry into Ross in a normal tackle and dominate the tackle, Ross doesn't get penalised. For some reason, the scrum, we watch it. It goes, you get a bit of dominance, you get to go forward, you see the arm come up, we'll say, and...
Well, just talk about, I don't understand what you mean by dominance.
So we're going forward, basically.
Okay.
But they
you're pushing
always,
the other team back.
Yeah, the other team's going backwards.
But they'll always, always penalise that.
Every time.
Every single time. And I don't understand that. So... in the old days, you could just get stuffed up, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You could just go forward backwards. But now they will, once it's about a meter, hey Ross, the arm comes out and there's a penalty advantage to the attacking team.
And usually the retreating team pops up, the front row stand up, and now the scrum collapses. Well, it doesn't collapse, it disintegrates.
The team that's penalised is the one going backwards at this point. Okay.
So it's very rare. Sometimes they'll get you when you're going forward, they'll say you came at an angle, that's how you got the dominance. That's very rare. It's just generally the team getting stuffed up or going backwards gets penalised for Ross as well. Standing up or maybe collapsing or walking around the corner. I mean, all this jargon, I don't understand. Over the cliff, around the corner, you know, all this stuff. But we understand that. I think what we don't understand, because you've seen a lot of the World Cup, is a scrum going down straight away. And then he's looking at his AR and then the penalty comes. And I can watch the same scrum 100 times, you know. So you will see the loose head going slightly down and the tight head hits his knees. And the penalty's against, because it's a low-hanging fruit, the tight head on his knees. But he wouldn't be on his knees if the loose head hadn't hinged or hadn't sort of bent over. And those are the penalties we're seeing in the World Cup now. Because the referee's under pressure to get the game restarted, so he's having to make the penalty call. But jeepers, I don't know which way they're going
to go. So it's almost forcing the penalty rather than a dominance thing. It's not winning the ball, it's forcing a penalty.
So it happens last week against Scotland. Those scrums, they got those two penalties towards the end of the first half. And people think the one penalty was fair, they did get us. The second one, I think, was France just going onto his knees. But there'd been no dominance, and you could see them celebrating. And that's a dangerous path to go down, because...
Were they celebrating about?
They won a penalty.
By how?
Well,
France went on his knees, but...
Forcing the tight head to go into his knees.
Yeah, but I know how they...
How? By creating a different angle.
Yeah, but so the loose head would have, we call hinged, basically folded. I don't know how you describe this on a podcast. But he's bent over, his head's gone below his knees. And so France has slipped off him onto his knees. If a referee sees a knees on, that's a penalty.
Right.
But there's no skill there. It's a dangerous path to go down. But the referees are under pressure. We can't have these two-minute scrums. So they... Yeah, we sit there in the coach's box thinking, yes, oh my gosh, that's against us. I understand the dominance
piece. I'm glad
piece.
I'm not the only one who thinks like that.
I understand the dominance piece completely. You see a scrum, we understand, hey Ross, whether it's right or wrong, I'm not sure.
Mm.
But the team going forward is going to get a penalty. But these ones where it just goes like this,
it's almost impossible to see.
Impossible. So, I promise you, if I scrummed against you and I'm like, one of us, we wouldn't, we could, one of us could go down, and we probably won't know what caused it.
You caused it,
So well, it's like, I mean, imagine the force that eight men who are highly trained and powerful and weigh 100 plus kilograms each. 900, what's it, 915 kilograms 950. In a pack. How much force they're applying to that contact point. And if the angles are even slightly wrong, something's giving, right? So you, so for there to be stability in a scrum, when you watch the first scrum and the ref says to the players, right, I want this, 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 what's he telling them?
He told him not to jump, stay on the mark. You want stability.
Hips level with shoulders, I guess.
Exactly, hips. Show your shoulders out so your shoulders are tucked in. Because if you took your shoulders tucked in, you're instantly at an angle. But you get these free kicks now for going, you can't.
So, so any one thing out of half a dozen that undermines stability and you've got 1,000-plus newtons being pushed onto that, it's going to cause something to go. And now the ref must figure out which one it was, and there's six options on each side. Yeah. It's very...
No, it's impossible. I mean, what World Rugby and Ross have been involved in, I'm not being funny, what we have fixed are the neck injuries at scrums. I mean, that's a massive thing. I mean, the game wouldn't be played now if we hadn't, I'm talking about rugby, hadn't got that right, because I was right, there were eight a year in Conradie, in the old Conradie Hospital from scrum. That was the worst one. Scrum goes down, keep pushing.
It collapses, neck.
Yeah, you do C1 or C2. So that's out. All our neck injuries.
How have they reduced that? Those
by bringing the teams so close, there's no big hit. It's basically gone. So it's almost a slide in. And the guy,
So you slide and then you push once the referee says.
So John's right. Like in the 90s and even into the late 90s, the sport's biggest crisis wasn't concussion. It was catastrophic injuries. And they didn't necessarily have to be fatal, but some were. But the difference, they always say, the difference between a fatal and a non-fatal catastrophic injury is luck. Because the same thing happens. Sometimes you die. Sometimes you it's crazy. And then every country in the world started to introduce these smart programs. We've got Box Smart. New Zealand had Rugby Smart. England's got its own program. And then part of that was the World Rugby funded a big study that was done out of Bath with the engineers. And they looked at different binding sequences. And they changed it eventually to what we see now, which is the CBS, right?
It's either a crouch. Yeah,
crouch, bind, set. At one moment it was touch, pause, engage, it was crouch, bind, set. So they've gone through these different evolutions of sequence to try and minimize that force, because the bigger that force, the more risk of that collapse.
I tell you what, Mike, we spend most of our budget by chance and by design on our front row. So Kitsoff, Mahuba, and Dwebo, Kitsoff's gone now. But it was a third of almost our budget.
Really?
So we had to get scrum penalties. And one of our frustrations in the URC was we get going forward and then the referee says, use it. And I'll go to these guys and say, crikey, man, it's 20 million rand there. Give it a chance to scrum. Because that's what we wanted. We sit in the coach's box. We've got a pack like ours, and I think South Africa at national level can do it. We'll call for a scrum to get the penalty. You can do it at malls as well. You know, if you ball for long enough, one of them's going to come in from the side or swim over. And you, so we're basically up there asking for penalties. We're a thing, what Ali, from Muhammad Ali, Ali Bumbaye, is our sharp punch in a scrum to get the penalty. It's not to try and, you're not going to score from 60 metres out. You're doing it for one reason, to get a penalty, you know.
So you're playing to your strengths.
You're playing to our strengths. And our field took it away from us because our guys kept slipping. So what happened was France, if you want to attack in the scrum, you've got to get your feet back, which is probably what France was trying to do against Scotland.
Exactly.
Your feet go back.
You're going to go on your knees.
You risk of being on your knees and then just penalty. But we've got a problem with the scrums because of just what you've raised. And obviously the time turn. I don't know how we solve it without compromising the safety, which is the most important bit.
Yeah. So here's a question. Is it possible that you can beat a bigger, stronger pack technically in the scrum? In other words, if you have a smaller, more technique, is it just about power and weight that will win that scrum 9 times out of 10?
It's changed a little bit. Look, I think you can with a smaller pack. I mean, it depends on the quality of the quality of the scrum. It is so technical and synchronized now. It's crazy. In the old days, just grab the guy. I mean, you must see the exercises these guys are doing before they get on the, they're amazing timing and height exercises and all this sort of stuff.
So give us an example of those exercises. These are for the guys in the scrum.
No, they've got their own machine which measuring what it's. What do you know? He's a scientist. You guys are scientists. Newton. They're doing their own hits against a machine in the wall, which is registering how long they can sustain that pressure.
Wow.
When they get the pressure back off, they're doing crawling exercises with guys hanging underneath them, like sort of baby monkeys on underneath a monkey crawling.
Wow.
The science and the machines are measuring all sorts of forces now. But it used to be on the opposition ball, we could kill them because the hooker has to strike. They reintroduced that about 3 or 4 years ago. Yeah. So there's a second where you are 8 against 7. So you want to attack that when he's hooker's foot up.
Mm.
It's changed a little bit now. Teams have become better at managing that. It's on our ball now that we can actually order the penalty. Mm. So what happens, even if you get the shove on their ball, they get it to the back, the referee says, play away, and off we go. Mm. So you spend a lot of energy and you haven't got the penalty. On our ball, we actually determine when the ball's out, don't we? So that's our ball. We get the ball to the back, the number 8, and we engage the diesels. Mm. And we have a go. Mm-hmm. But their flanks are starting to look now because the ball's at the back. They know it's going to 10.
Yes.
They're starting to look. They've got a shoulder up. And we get them with a second shove, and that's when we get the penalty. So we're actually attacking more the scrum of our ball than their ball.
So there is micro tactics in that, just by you saying things like the flanks looking up because they want to know where the ball is.
Oh, I'll tell you a stupid one. We've got a thing called a schultzy, which is the ball goes to the back of the scrum. The move's called a schultzy, but we're the scrum off calls break. Their flanks completely think the ball's up, and we just got 2-3, and we keep the ball in, and we're scrumming against 6. That's it. So I was changing the name now, but the Schultzies break 2-3.
Okay.
It's just this big shatter break. I promise you, their flanks are gone.
For you as a coach, is it the most? It seems to me, with the way that you talk about it, it's a real passion for having a passion for the game. That's one area of the game that you can feel quite excited about, because for most of us watching the game, we want the winger to get the ball and scream down the outside and score over the line. But actually understanding that forward battle and understanding it will make your enjoyment of the game when you're watching it better. So talking to you about this kind of gives me an idea of what's going on there.
I think that they're definitely taking too long. We know if we can get a scrum put in on 78 minutes, we've won. If we're the lead,
yeah,
we can wind it down to 80.
Kill it through the forwards,
and that's a problem. Yeah. And I think, but there, people go on about the maul and the scrum. It's the one area I like, the power of the scrum, and I like getting the penalties, and it also keeps the game. We need 130 kilogram players out there. If we're going to be 90, I promise that field's going to be, it's going to be in rugby league and too crowded. So the scrum is one area where you've got almost 2 tons concentrated, or 16 guys concentrated. Likewise, the maul. People say
what it is, roughly 2 tons of player.
Well, it's a 950.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, hundred the
2 tons. Yeah, 930 kilograms
of player. Yeah, the scrum master. That you've got 18 players in there. And it's easily 2 tons. Yeah,
bit of space. And the same with the maul. I know they're boring, but the teams are getting much better at the attack off mauls now. So when the referees are shouting, use it, they're much better players. In the old days, it wasn't like that. But now you've got 16 guys in there. And if you don't put six, if you as a defensive team, don't put 8 in, or we're going to keep raping, we're going to keep going until you put the 8 in to stop us.
Right.
And if we put 2 backs in, put 2 backs. But what's nice about the balls now, we're seeing tries scored from balls. They're almost set players. Before it wasn't really like that. But I think it's another chance for us to concentrate people in one area of the field to have more space.
And do you think South African teams, I mean, we talk about South African teams being very physical. Is that a sort of a South African methodology around that sort of forward enforcement and those tries that come from those sort of set pieces that demals? I mean, it feels like it's a South African thing, or maybe even a Southern Hemisphere thing compared to the other nations.
Look, I think you alluded to it before, it is a connoisseur's thing to watch teams. Like watching France All Blacks in that opening game. Mm. I thought All Blacks were superb in the first half. And I thought, jeepers, there's something happening here. But then just the grind. Because the French are the one, to my mind, the one team who can do what we can do.
Yes, I think so as well.
They can out-muscle you, basically.
So the other teams,
and it's different, right? So a lot of fans are still saying, oh, yeah, French flair. And so not anymore. Like the French are actually us version 2.0.
100% right. Yeah. So the All Blacks, New Zealand, Ireland need really, sorry, All Blacks, New Zealand, All Blacks, Scotland, Ireland need really, which is all ours, fast ball. The French don't actually need fast ball. They can dominate physically with them all, and then, one of their big carriers, and they make them all flood to the pond. But we have got, I know it's not attractive, but it just takes the legs of the opposition. Mm. And it takes sometimes, I think I did a stat when the Bulls were at their prime under Heineke. They scored half their more tries, half a minute 65 to 80. It's that, that slow poison, which is not by nature attractive, but we are the best in the world at it, by without question. It's boring, but it's
effective.
Unfortunately, yes. And it suits well. It's where rugby is at the moment.
Mm. If you as a coach had to change one thing about the game now, what would you change?
It's a small point, is the goal line dropout, this new system. So I don't mind if they dot it down.
Explain that again.
So if you go over the goal line, Ross and I do a great move. I drive Ross over the line. We've been battering away for 12 phases. If we can see Ross hasn't got it held up. So all our work, we're going to get the ball back on our 10-yard line.
I remember what used to happen then, held up, is a five-meter scrum to the attacking team. So they remained on attack. And about 3 years ago, just before COVID, maybe just before or after COVID, close to that, they changed it so that it would no longer be a five-meter attacking scrum, but the defending team would now have a goal line dropout.
Okay.
So I don't mind the goal line dropout if other teams voluntarily put the ball down. But if Roscoe and I get rewarded for that great attacking play, literally we're going to receive it back on our 10-yard instead of the five. So it doesn't reward really good attacking play.
It basically restarts the game without any benefit, really.
Well, to detriment. When we go back.
Yeah, you've gone, you lose 50 metres. And then the other thing is, with my player welfare hat on, is it creates a situation where, and you see teams do it, you'll nominate who that receiver's going to be. And you don't want that receiver to be Cheslin Kolbe. You want that receiver to be Dwayne Vermeulen or like Billy Vunipola for England. So it's the biggest guy. And then the kicking team sends the biggest guy. And all you've done is you've created a massive high-speed collision in the middle of the field. It makes me very nervous from a welfare perspective as well. So on two fronts, I also have some thoughts about that one.
The other law I'd change, they're making progress with this bunker thing. Have you seen this bunker thing where they put a yellow card and decide? That's much more accurate. But we're at the mercy of TV producers the whole time. I know what my feeling is, what we should do is only look at try scoring. Unless Ross headbutts you, it's completely obvious. Leave the foul play and actually go and look at that whole competition's round over the weekend. And on Monday, an email comes, Mike Finch, Stormers, headbutting, 7 weeks, like proper. But at least it's equitable. Look, I think the bunker system may have solved this anyway. But this idea of, because we get told by Wayne Barnes, who's a great guy, a great referee. Last year we played some European. He said, if you get a high shot against British Lions, lie down, because it gives us a chance to have a look at it. And to me, that's anti-rugby. So guys getting high shots now are lying down. They're doing it less now because Ross is going to have them all for a concussion test. So they don't want to go off. But people are milking that. You know, I think, and all the producers are being, like we all shot down to the producer. Replay that. They should rather replay a highlight of the game or show a picture of Table Mountain. But replaying like this and that, it's a messy situation. I would say just go over the weekend and then like rugby league, refer and then just knock the guy out of rugby rather than having these inconsistencies. I mean, Jesse Creel versus Sam, look, I don't think Jesse was a red card, do you?
No, I think there have been images now in the last day or two that have come out, and I saw others, and you couldn't make out clear head contact, and he very clearly hit the ball first. If his alignment was even 5 centimetres off, it would have been a flush head contact, but I don't think it was, no.
So what you're saying, I mean, I'm just understanding you correctly, in does that not endanger players? Doesn't it kind of give players almost licence to go, well, we're just going to... We're going to do whatever we like. It's going to encourage...
No, because the ban must be proper and salary taken off. But at least we're going to get consistency. Our frustration as coaches, we sit there. I sit on a... there's a world... the World Rugby foul play calibration.
Yeah.
And we vote every week on this incident. I don't think we've had one, Ross, where... And it's proper on the same committee, Ross, Conrad Smith, players, referees, Andrew Brace is on it. There's not been one thing... where we've all agreed.
It's a high-profile group, that, and it's a pretty good group. Eh? You've got to say, that's where I sometimes get a bit pissed off, because you'll see people say, oh, the suits and ties are deciding. The suits and ties are John and Jacques Nienaber and Conrad Smith and Andrew Brace, and it's really good guys. But John's right, they'll watch 13 clips, and if you get 90% agreement, it's good.
Yeah.
Wow. And sometimes I thought it would go the other way around.
No.
So there's such a disparity in opinion.
Because of what we said on the last podcast, you've got to say, is there head contact, yes or no? And that's not even obvious. Yeah. Look at the Creel instance. Is there foul play, yes or no? And I said on the previous podcast, it's Sam Curry, it's Tom Curry, my bad.
Yeah.
That one, people say, well, not foul play. So there's a dispute. Is it foul play? Is it not? Then you've got to go to degree of danger, another subjectivity, and then mitigation, another subjectivity. So it's really difficult to get even the very top experts to be aligned. So it's no wonder there's inconsistencies.
Sure.
And it's the coach's frustration. And I'm judging from what I see on social media, it's a fan frustration. The thing is, the sport can't afford not to sanction it, because then you're basically allowing a culture of head impacts that don't go sanctioned. And we have often gone back and forth. Is the moment there's an on-field sanction followed by a post-match sanction. The on-field is that red card, and then it's the 6 week down to three, maybe down to two. What John's saying is maybe you don't have it as strong on field, but then you must load it at the back.
That's exactly what I think.
Or you have to load it stronger on the field. Because remember we discussed they want to do a 20-minute red card.
Yeah.
So 10 for a yellow, 20, and then a replacement. And then the sport pushes back for two reasons. The team say, no, we want to be the beneficiaries of a red card. Like you ask Uruguay, would they rather have had a red card last night? Yes, of course. Because now we get 14 men in opposition.
Yeah, well, that's a good point.
So the team's often, it's often gone to a vote. We don't want this. But the other thing is it softens the sanction. So it's almost tolerating head impacts.
Mm.
So the balance between what happens on versus post-match is a delicate, tricky one. At the moment, they complain that the sanction's too harsh, though. 3 weeks for that? I mean, that's ridiculous. Imagine you'd have 8 weeks, but not a red card. Mm. So what do you do? It's a dilemma, right? That's the, I guess I'm going to make the point. It's it's quite difficult.
I can
see
why the coaches struggle with it.
Excuse me, sorry.
We know John's got a bit of a cold, so we're going to let him back a bit of a thing. So an interesting question, and another one comes across as a sort of a naive question about rugby, but why don't rugby players, because there is some level of protection that players can have on the field. They can wear shoulder pads, they can wear skull caps, all that sort of thing. I will ask John this first, and I actually want Ross's opinion on this as well. Do you think rugby players should be allowed to wear more protection?
Yeah, I really am. Ross's is really much more his question.
In other words, what does the culture of the sport and the players think about
no
that?
No desire. I mean, the amount of scrum caps, the helmets, is minimal now. Though I think they're more prevalent when 20 years ago.
Mm.
The guys generally don't, they'll strap injuries. They're not actually after, I think they feel more comfortable if their injuries are looked after. They're not, the players generally are not scared or worried going into games. And the catastrophic injuries tend to be, I know that Ross is much more on the clinician side, are catastrophic injuries are a leg twist or ACL is the big one. And there's there's no protective gear around that. So there's no demand for the players to feel like they want to absorb. I mean, I don't know what the science is. I heard it's not very good, but everybody could wear a scrum cap, but they don't go for it too.
Which I'm surprised at, because I think if as a player, if I was even at no matter what level of the game, if I've got a scrum cap on, it might not necessarily prevent a concussion, but if I'm going to go into a whole bunch of boots and arms and heads, a little bit of protection gives you a little bit of confidence in a way, doesn't it? I mean, if you've got shoulder pads, you can go into a tackle potentially harder.
I tell you, nobody is wearing shoulder pads. Nobody in my team is wearing. And they were big in the 2000s.
Yes, remember.
Not one shoulder pads.
No.
Because the gloves were stupid. Very few guys wearing helmets.
Mm.
Even mouth guards.
Yeah.
Some players don't even wear mouth guards.
Really?
Mm.
That's surprising.
They're generally not scared of injury. They'll be scared of, as Ross is right, an ACL, which puts their career out, but there's nothing they can do.
Mm.
And we had a guy, Dan Duplessis, got 3 concussions, thought about retiring, comes back, plays without a mouth guard.
Mm.
It's remarkable. Mm. Fearlessly.
Mm.
I wouldn't be like that. I wouldn't be able to turn off like that, but they've got this ability to do it.
It's like playing test cricket without a helmet, really, in that respect, isn't it? I mean, it's scary stuff. Eh? So when you talk about, you touched on the idea of fear. When you look at your team, when I think of things like the Rugby World Cup back in 1995 and that vision of Jonah Lomu basically running over everybody, do you have instances in your team where where players are legitimately scared of the opposition? And you never had that where players go, oh, I don't want to be up against that guy today, or you can see nervousness.
Never ever had it.
Mm.
They always think that they can do it. They might be aware of a guy they've got to be aware of from a tactical point of view, but I've never known them to be worried about a guy beating them, never. I don't think
Or hurting them.
Or hurting them, no. Never, ever. I've never seen it. I've never come across in the change room, never seen it afterwards.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
They can be worried about the consequences of defeat, but never worried about a physical smack. It's funny, yeah.
Yes, because the average person probably looks at it and goes, well, if I see Evan Etzebeth charging at me and I'm a scrum off.
I'm sidestepping it for sure.
Yes.
No, but they'll be thinking, oh, I'm going to have a go to Evan. Bring it on. I'm going to have a go.
I suppose by the time you get to any decent level of rugby, you've filtered out someone who doesn't want to do it.
True.
The sport deselects you.
Yes.
It's true. That's exactly right.
That's what it is. It's always like the people you see on television have already been chosen by their attitude towards contact.
Mm. That's a great point. Any guy who bails it, we call it like a poach, you know, when you come for a steal and you've got your hands on the ball
and you're going
to
get it.
You see that the cleaner's coming. We call it bailing out of a poach. The guy is going to spit himself out the system. You've got to stay in that poach. You know what I mean?
Mm.
Even if there's a leading shoulder coming. So that'll be a massive black guy that's a black mark. He's not,
yeah.
You know, and Rusty talks a lot about guys who prepare to go into dark holes and dark places and stay there. That sort of jargon.
Mm.
Mm. Do they then, after they've finished playing, and you're part of, I guess, a former players network and you know some of them, do they look back with some concern over the attitude they had towards it then, or not even then? No regrets? Fear at the time and no regrets afterwards?
No, I think our players are completely oblivious to the concussion issue. You know, like if you talk about whether there was a guy, the Iron Man, and this week, the Welshman.
Poppin.
You know, he's, 45, 44, early onset dementia, got kicked in the head in the start of the swim at Porthcawl or wherever it was in Swansea. But our players have got not one, they're not even thinking like, it's weird. The UK are very aware of it. You know, how many times you hit a scrum machine, our guys are not there anywhere off. I don't know if we're going to pay that bill later.
I don't know either. I don't know. I'm not sure.
It just doesn't cross. Our players are very old school like that. Go out there, murder them, enjoy it, and look back with fondness of their stories.
Yeah.
We're way behind the awareness that Steve Thompson's got his book, Unforgettable, and that stuff. We know when you're there.
So we talked a bit on the podcast about this whole dilemma about, you know, player welfare and how much contact you should have in training versus game time. Now, you as a coach, that's obviously a bit of a balancing act because you don't want to over give them too much contact because of just the effects of that. How do you toughen players up for the game? Because there's a toughening up process that allows them to take physical contact that you have to train. So how do you find that balance?
Yeah, look, we've gone away with all contact during the week.
And before, no contact in the week.
No, none.
And this is just before you continue. We come under so much pressure to reduce contact. And then you ask the coaches how much they do, and a lot of them say that. So then you go back to these advocacy groups and you say, what would you like to reduce from zero to where exactly?
Ross is
crazy. We're being told to solve a problem that actually doesn't exist. In a lot of it, look, there are some coaches who don't have this mindset, but a lot of the time it's not a problem, and yet you're proposing it as a solution and beating rugby with it as a stick.
And do you think most coaches are like that? There's a minimum contact.
Listen, I don't think it's, in my case, I don't think it's coming from an altruistic place. I'm coming from, I just don't want to see, you know, an ACL or a concussion in training. I can't.
It's
so devastating.
The coach has an incentive set that actually makes for good behaviours around contact. Yeah. If you smash them four times a week for 20 minutes a day, you will have half a squad available every game, and then you will lose.
Mm.
So they've modified their behaviour to win, and it happens to have welfare implications that are positive.
So we would have to make up as close we can get as up-down work, or, you know what I mean, like tackling somebody onto a tackle, a big flat puffy cushion, you know, and good repeatedly or repeated up downs. But there won't be any cleaning. Cleanings are horrible, you know, no cleaning whatsoever.
It's vicious.
We won't even do leg tackle. Probably Ross is dead right. It's perfectly aligned in that respect.
So then if I said to you, injuries in matches are often caused by tackle technique and ruck entry technique, how are you training them to be technically proficient if you're not allowed to give them contact?
Yeah. So we do some tackle stuff onto the bat. We're doing it this week onto the big, it's like a long jump cushion, you know, the thing those guys land on.
Yes.
So we do a lot of just trying to get their heads right. Cleaning, we don't. It's just too dangerous. We'll do cleaning against shields, but then that's completely, it's very far removed from the from real thing. We've even thrown away our body armor. A lot of teams obviously that's a Robocop body armor. We don't even use that because it's too similar to contact. But it's purely self-survival. I just don't want to lose guys for that Saturday. So that's a good point, Ross, that we are not teaching them enough of that is probably more the danger.
Yeah, we had a meeting back in 2017, I think it might have been, with the defence coaches. That was when Jock Nienaber was still the SA defence coach, and Sean Edwards was there for Wales and so on. And they said, we hardly teach tackle technique in training. We work on defensive systems and decision-making and line speed. But in the same conversation, they'll tell you that tackle technique is the main contributing factor to head injuries in the game. So then you have this dilemma. And then you say, well, in that case, we should teach more of it. But then people say, no, less contact, not more. So, okay. So here's a paradox. How do we solve this?
So you're saying that the toughening up process to get them ready for contact in a game is just because they play regularly and they've come through the system where they can take it anywhere.
Yeah.
So there's not contact training, in other words.
No.
So not a toughening up process close to a match or something like that.
No. Look, we'll do up-down work to get them not just running fit.
Up-down work is what? Tackling, getting up.
Tackling, tackle backs, getting up.
Yeah, it's not live tackles. It's not bone on. It's what Richard Gray always calls bone on bone type full intensity tackle. It'll be up in small, slight contact.
So that really is quite alarming. If you think about it, you're not going to do it the whole week, or if you've missed the previous week with injury or not being selected, and your next game is to have a full steam, Marcel Coutier running against you. It's crazy, but it's true.
And that's why injuries predict future injuries, in part because once you're injured, you deny yourself training opportunities and then you're not ready for the demand of the match.
Yeah.
It's a brutal sport now, Mike. It's unrecognized. I finished playing 20 odd years ago just because the guys are so fit and fast. And I mean, I held a tackle bag the other day for Zas, who's a medium to largest size wing, but he's not Jonah Lomu. And I had boots on and I held the thing as low as I could. And I held it and he drove from a meter away. Next thing I know, Doc Suter was looking at me. You know, I was lying on my back, my head of the stars. This was a win from a meter's runoff. He destroyed me.
Yeah. So that actually is, even though you're not doing contact, there's some pretty physical hits in training.
Yeah, there are. That's what it is.
Mm. So those hits are interesting to wonder whether they can be reduced somehow. But do you want to?
Well, what's interesting, that was one of my questions. How has the game, do you think, developed in the last two decades to where it is now? So you're suggesting that the pure physical strength of the players is pronouncedly very different from what it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, we all said in the 80s how much the game had evolved, and the England backs of the 1990 were bigger than the England forwards of pre-Second World War. But what I've just seen, the guy like Frans Mahomer now, he should have been, I don't know if you watched, there was one game last weekend where Titan just got, somebody launched a crazy counter-attack. Flip, I can't remember what.
Wasn't it the French replacement hooker over down the left side touchline?
It was on the left
and then he ended up kicking ahead.
Yeah, I think. But the point, Frans Mahomer, we should all have been able to run round. Now France can move properly, laterally, forward. So there's no space out there, and the hits are just enormous. Yeah, I say, I reckon 10 years ago, Avia Pinel is almost like a. And he can move. He's almost the last of a breed. Yeah, if France can't fold on defence and fan out and get off the line, you're not going to choose him. So these big guys, so they're just the whole thing of the piano movers being concentrated, and the little wing, Shane Williams could see France in front of him and step him. It doesn't exist anymore. France can catch that guy and put in the hit, and that's what's making it really scary. I mean, I think it's a brutal, and also it's a problem for the refereeing, because those breakdowns are so high speed, so fast, so much power, it's impossible.
Yeah.
The game's outgrowing, it's out developing, our conditioning itself, I think.
So when you look at the game now, and having discussed with Ross on this podcast the changes in the rules and the fact that the tackle law has changed, we suggest that the tackle law makes the game slightly more open because players might get away from a tackle easier. Do you think that the kinds of players will change in the next 5 years? And if you do, what do you think about when you're starting to choose the Stormers of 2028, for instance?
I think what we've got to do is keep the scrum, keep the line out so we can get different shaped people. Because otherwise, rugby league's 13. And, you know, even that's not attractive. It's, you know, it's four or five tough tackles before there's any form of play. We're 15. So unless we're going to have to keep concentrating people. So we have to make it a reward for the scrum, which is boring. We have to, otherwise, if we're all going to, every athlete's going to look exactly the same. 110 kilograms, 1.9 meters, really fast. And I think that'd be devastating for.
And you don't think it's going to go that way?
What do you think?
No,
the wind direction is blowing it in that direction.
Yes,
I think. Yeah.
And you're suggesting that that's not good for the game.
I think that field's going to be too crowded, and it's too hard to look. There are law changes we can make. I think we should let playing on the ground, playing the ball on the ground, for example, happen. Because I think, you know, leaving this ground is creating these high, these disastrous interpretations of the breakdown. Just let the guy play on the ground. Whoever wins it, you'll find, you know, wins it. I'd even let, Ross would be horrified, let the old-fashioned rucking come. So not that you can kick somebody, but I would just get more people concentrated around the breakdown to create more space, you know. Because if we fill 15 athletes in a row, what's it, 70 metres, one every 4 metres.
That's nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Oh, literally, our wingspan will cover it. Right. That's going to be brick wall stuff, you know. So that's the, yeah.
It's so interesting, right? Because whenever the decision makers and the experts talk about the breakdown, they want faster ball, cleaner ball. The consequence of that is fewer players will go in.
100% right.
Yeah. And even Jacques said to me once, he said, if I can't pressure the ruck, I'm going to pressure the pass. And so I'd rather have 14 players on their feet.
That's exactly right.
So that I can hit you not at the first, at the ruck with the point of the tackle. I'm going to rush up and hit you at receiver one, receiver two, receiver three.
Mm.
And the problem is that the faster you hit receiver one, two, and three, the more the risk of injuries go up there. So again, it's one of those classic dilemmas where there's a tension between the welfare requirement and the... And so when you say I'd be horrified at the racking, it has been discussed. It's come up, and I'm not, because I know that what it would do is it would bring three or four more players there, and then you couldn't rush up anymore, because you'll only rush up if you're numbered up. And like the 50-22 rule, I don't know what your thoughts are on that, that was created in part to try and compel the team without the ball to put one player back so that there would be a bit more space in the backfield. And so they know that the space, rugby is all about manipulating space, and the only way you do that is you put people in the black space and white space, you know, closed and open. And so the welfare thing and the, sometimes they're aligned, but sometimes they're in opposition.
So the suggestion that you suddenly want a whole bunch of highly mobile players actually is not necessarily a good thing for the sport, because you need those big, heavy guys contesting the ball.
And then nor is this drive for 50 minutes ball in play.
You don't think it's a good thing?
No.
That's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
And like they say, 32-minute ball in play, unattractive. We'd rather have 40 minutes ball in play. And then average is what, 36 to 38?
What do you mean by, in other words, the playing time that's...
The actual live playing time. So when I get a penalty, the clock stops. Well, the game clock keeps going, but the ball in play clock stops, right? And until that line-out is thrown in, it's actually dead time. And there's a school of thought that you want to minimize that as much as possible. But then I'm looking at that and saying, now we've got 45 minutes of ball and play time. That means there'll be 30% more tackles, 30% more exposure to risk. It's just not, so that's also driving welfare issues, I think.
Yeah, I think Ross is right. You know, we sit at a game, our coach, and we actually don't know what that ball and play was. And we think it was a good game. And we walked on and somebody says 29 minutes. I don't think the spectator really knows the difference.
I don't think so either.
And also, this fuff going box... coming back box, that's ball in play. That's shit ball in play. It's terrible ball in play. So I agree with Ross. Chasing ball in play we have to keep the big guys on the field. You know, we have to have this, you know, chasing ball in play. We're going to condition like marathon runners. And then I think the sport gets into trouble.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the other thing about ball in play, the paradox is when there's a try, ball in play time by definition stops for 90 seconds because that's the time to give a conversion. So sometimes you look at it and you say, geez, the ball in play time was low. That's because there were 11 tries in the match. So, okay, is ball in play the right metric then to judge if there were 11 tries? Maybe not. Maybe there's something other, something that we should be looking at in addition.
So you're creating quite nice segues for me here, because you just mentioned the boxing the ball all the time. So one of the frustrations, if you sit at any rugby match and whether you're a South African or an English supporter or whatever, the team kicks the ball down the field into the other half of the other field, and then there's just kicking back and forth. We know that it's about gaining territory, but it's extremely frustrating to watch as a fan. Is there an alternative to that, or is that just that you have to be able to control the game in the opposition half, and there's no other way of doing it? What's your view on that?
I think, look, the box kicks drive me. Those box kicks, you know, drive me mad. I thought they were going to go. I thought we saw a change. I thought they were going to go towards more what we call the open field contestables.
So we're talking about box kicks. It's coming out the scrum. The scrum off takes it.
Fuff with these things going.
Exactly. And you see the caterpillar forms. The Southern Hemisphere teams don't do the caterpillar. It's a Northern Hemisphere thing where they load the back of the rack with 1, 2, 3, 4 guys, because that then stops the defending team from then charging the kick down. So it's a pain.
And the goal is position. The goal is territory.
I think we've moved it a little bit away from wanting to have territory. That used to be the case. I tell you what, so there's been a disastrous law interpretation, I think. So what happens now, if I kick one of those contestables, we call them, the up-and-handers, the old-fashioned up-and-handers, and I kick it to Ross. Ross is the fullback or the wing about to receive this thing with hordes coming down. Okay, there's a whole lot of grey area in between because we're all blocking each other. Yes. Almost like, yeah. We call it bubbling. Some people call it escorting.
There's a lot of people getting in the way.
Which is hard to referee. But Ross, as the last guy in defence, has to catch that ball. So the lawyer, the referees used to say, and if you were taking Mike, you go up and contest with Ross. We used to say, you have to be in a realistic position to catch the ball. And that was good, I thought. Ross hasn't got the luxury of being able to tap it back because he's the last guy. If he taps it back going to his try line, he's going to concede dramatic territory or points. Now they're interpreting it like, no, you, Mike, the attacking chaser, has to be in a realistic position to play the ball. And that's a massive difference to catch. So now what's that?
Because he can knock it backwards.
No, he can knock it back. Mm. So he's jumping up from 3 yards away, just going like this. He's not, but no attempt to catch it. He can destroy Ross. It's a player safety-wise, it's a disaster. And also, it's reallowing these kicks to actually have a return because I can, worst case scenario, I chase the kicker, you chase onto Ross, you knock it on, it's Ross's scrum, big deal. But Ross has got, he's got to catch the ball. And that to me is encouraging more box kicks and it's allowing for a horrible collision, a worse collision in the air.
Mm.
Whereas if you have to stop and jump like this, I think it's a safer collision. I thought there was going to be a trend towards on-field, open-field contestables, which the All Blacks do, Barrett does well, Marnie Lowell does. Which is more attractive, you know, there's no room for the escort, you know, the jump isn't so much because nobody, the ball isn't coming down, you don't know exactly where it's coming down. I think what teams are, we certainly try, and I think the Springboks are going that way, we're not trying to win the territory, we're trying to do what Ross said, we're trying to manipulate the backfield so that those guys exit a poor kick onto us to allow us to counterattack. So I think there's a bit more of attacking fear, you know, you've got to put three back, if you don't, we'll find an open field. And you'll have to kick an exit kick onto us and then we can have a crack at you, either off the line out or the counter-attack. It's not so much about being in the half. We want the South African rugby, sorry, I'm going on a lot now, has changed a lot. We've finally discovered that we've got backs through a good transformation program, real X-factor backs. We almost got the island equivalent where All Blacks beat us for years. Our wings used to be these military medium guys who just finishers. Now we've got real X-factors, so we're trying to create chaos. So I think that's what the kicking game is more about, is trying to create chaos to attack.
Okay, with you.
And that's why, like, you watch New Zealand, France. Yeah. New Zealand contested every kick.
Mm.
France didn't contest kicks even when they were contestable. So they'd kick an up and under, and their players are there. They still didn't go up for them. Right. I think they've worked out the risk of doing it's too high, giving away penalties and cards.
But why are they kicking it? Why are they kicking it then?
Because they want New Zealand to have the opportunity to play, kick it to us, and then we'll see where there's space. And if you don't, okay, we go two phases, we kick it back, and see what you got then. Kick it again, okay, now we finally found that space, and then we got Penno or Villiers, wherever it is. And we do very much the same thing. Oh, it's a couple of phases, and if you haven't broken through it, couple phases, then your safest, highest yield option is to kick to see if you can create a new shape, new pattern to look at.
But a kick always feels like it's a 50-50 as opposed to a guarantee when you have possession. So when you have possession, you have the ball, therefore you can do things and you can recycle and create more opportunity that way. Kicking away the ball, you're potentially giving the opposition a chance to get back at you and you don't have, you've got to defend.
Yeah, so
that's why I struggle as a fan to look at that and go, I don't understand.
The area sort of in the middle of the field, the middle 30 yards, we call middle earth. Now, if we're playing in middle earth, then we've got the ball and we're through 3-4 phases, I'll be starting to get edgy, get rid of it. I tell you why, because if you just get one breakdown isolated against the Bulls, for example, domestically, because against the Springboks internationally, a holding penalty there because you've overplayed. So your cleaners are more accurate in the first two or three phases. You know, the fourth phase is getting a bit looser. They get a holding penalty. They've got either 3 points or they've got a 22-meter entry. So you're defending them more. So don't give the worst place to give penalties. In our 22, I don't mind the stuff about us giving away a penalty because either they've got there so they can have their three or we'll have another go defending them in the line-out, but they've got there. But in that area, the middle earth, don't give away a penalty. And it's miserable. But we don't, Ross is right. Marnie Libbock will tell him, Marnie, we'll give you two or three to have a look. But if it's not, just get rid of it. And the get rid of it is what Ross is saying is dead right. We're not getting rid of it, just give them a chance to attack. Because if they want to attack against us, if they want to take five or six phases, Dion Free will get in at one stage and we'll get the penalty. If they want to kick it back, then your chase line better be good. I will give it back to you as soon as we see your chase line staggered a bit. So it's quite tactical. It is unattractive. I think it's sad in rugby that you not you, that you can get punished for playing.
Yeah.
But that's where the game pretty much is at the moment.
Yeah.
Four or five phases, I reckon teams are getting edgy.
Mm.
In the 22, different story.
Ireland's different, though.
100%.
And so that's interesting. So we'll play Ireland in, this is South African-centric now, but we got Ireland not this weekend, next. What are they looking to do?
Exactly. Ross is right. They're the multi-phase team of Ireland. They want, they've got 13 phases worked out.
Yeah.
But we played against Leinster. Now, we got Dion Free, who's probably one of the best Steelers in the world. I don't think, and Munster in the final, I don't think Dion touched the ball. You know, normally, you know, if you come for a steal, you can get your hands, maybe you get cleaned. They are so accurate at the breakdown. They're so organized.
Mm.
Ross is right. That's the different model.
Yeah. And, so what are you trying to do against them?
So what
when you're the Stormers against Leinster, what's your objective?
And I think we've talked with the Springboks, some of the Springboks staff about the same model, is that we did it. I think we saw in that game in Auckland where we got pumped. Do you remember the one at Mount Pleasant?
Yeah, earlier this year, Mount Smart, I think it's called.
And they, that second half, I thought we showed the template how we're going to win the World Cup. Was we slowed their ball down so dramatically with that counter-rucking. So Peter Steph, so what Jock, he's right, Jock was very much 14 guys on their feet. Get the, if he can get 15, if the tackler can get out, we got 15 on our feet, great. But suddenly they were putting Malcolm Marks, which is a pity now, Peter Steph, Eben, coming in as an extra guy to counter-ruck. So the Irish are having to put an extra cleaner in, or the New Zealand's in that game. When we play the Ireland, watch the counter-ruck. If we slow their ball down, they're going to be forced to kick and the thing changed. Yeah, because if they slow down, we can get off the line and we can have line speed and they won't be as comfortable. You know, it's nice to have a five-phase plan, but the problem is from the third phase is a Mr. Eben Etzebeth hitting you, like Mike Tyson says, getting punching you in the face. And then you're gone. So I think what you're going to see in that game, we didn't do that much against Scotland because Scottish were technically woeful. They tried to play off 10 and they didn't play off Schumann or Schumann or whatever it's called, off 9. But this, we've got the physical capability and the aggression and the dog to counter-ruck. Marks is a massive loss to this.
Massive.
Yeah. He's probably the player, if you wrote the whole team, he'd be daylight, the world player we could least afford to lose. Because you've got one of the world's best steelers, one of the world's best counter-ruckers, and one of the world's best hookers. There's three positions. Yeah. So, but I think that's what we're going to do. It's going to be it's two extreme ideologies. One team who doesn't want the ball, who wants to stuff you up. And one team wants to get through the phases.
When you're a coach and you've got these stylistic opposites, would you rather play someone stylistically more similar to yourselves or someone very different? So now we're talking, I guess, World Cup context. And I'm sorry for listeners who are English or Australian, whatever. We're South African-centric. We could play France, who are very similar to us, or we could play Ireland, who are completely opposite to us.
The cutlass and the rip. My feeling is that we can control the physical dominance of Ireland, Scotland, New Zealand. I'm not sure the French have just got the ability to stand up to us. If you take that away from us, I thought Scots would do better. If you take away the scrum penalties or the maul penalties or the counter ruck, then I think we're in trouble. You know, I do. I think against Ireland, we can control that. You know, we can counter ruck. We can slow them down. It worries me against the French who've got the physical. Look, Willems is a big loss for them. Who would you? The team I'm most scared of would be France.
After the first game, France.
Well, we'll see, because if you're listening to this podcast now and those games are already over, you'll know whether we predicted them right or not. Tell me, who is the... So when we look up at the box at an international game or a game that you at your level, who is in that box and what are they doing?
They're probably like 4 or 5, so you'll have the law... Ross's law is that you will have the fast side's generally a physio.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Springboks were a hell of an advantage when Jacques was there before, because to have a really good coach like he is, it's a brilliant coach on this. So we only had one medic the far side and only one doc roaming. Obviously, we manipulate like South Africa down the water.
This is in the box.
Upstairs, you've got the head coach and the forward, traditionally the forwards coach, the attack coach. Maybe there's a breakdown coach or a kicking coach.
Mm-hmm.
Kicking coach tends to be down on the field because he's chatting to the kicker the whole time. And then there's an analyst or two analysts. And basically what they're doing, they're doing live coding. So that'll be just so we've got a picture of where we are with territory, where we are with breakdown speed. So they're coding.
And that's for after the game or the game is happening? Again.
It's live.
So that's trying to get us to halftime. After halftime, it tends to take a life of its own.
So for you as a coach, you've got all those people with you.
Yeah.
What are you talking to them during the game and how can you affect the game on the field from that feedback?
Look, the coach's box is a terrible environment. It's fraught. It's temper. It's anything, everything it shouldn't be. Because we're shouting at each other. We're swearing. We're going down with messages about the past. Tell Ross Tucker never, ever to put his head in that breakdown again, which is completely wrong. We should be telling Ross what the next plan is. We're getting a bit better with it. But
so it's an emotional place.
But it's trying to be analytical, but it's overrun. It's overcome by emotion.
Exactly what it is. It's awful. And the coaches are going at each other. We're going at each other. We're fighting for the radio. You know, I'm on the radio. Darby wants to put a message on. We're getting better.
So radio, who are you talking to?
What's basically happening in the ideal world without the emotion, we should be forward looking at the next task. So that Crick might, he's the line-out defence guy, he's got a computer, might be saying, listen, they're closing middle and front ball in the line-out. So then the message might go down to the physio, the doc, tell them to take front ball options for the next while.
And how is he communicating that?
It's on radio to the physio, the doctor.
And how is he communicating that to the player?
And he's at any water break or feigned injury. So we'll have calls.
The feigned injury?
Yeah. No, we're not unique. A brunt. Yeah. If you can put a proper hooker down at scrum time, the referee has to stop play.
Right.
It's just he can't scrum without them.
So it's a communication gap.
He'll go, the doctor shot for this. Francie, Brunt. Francie will go down with it before scrum, gives us a chance, and then the water carriers will go. So if it's a backline thing or a kicking thing, the water carrier goes straight to Marnie. If it's a line-out thing, somebody's going to Marvin Ori. Depends how many carriers we allowed on, two or three.
Right.
So it's just tactical stuff about going forward. During a game, they're shouting the whole time. So as the play goes up, you'll see them, the physio on the far side, the doctor, he is shouting the whole time. Discipline, whatever the story is. Some of it's complete white noise. A lot of it is.
Mm.
But there are tactical things. As soon as there breaks, those guys are going on with messages. That's why you see the hand coming up.
Yes.
We'll instruct them, show us that Gareth, you to Marnie to look at the bozo.
Mm.
And then the hand will come up, okay, and the Marnie's got the bozo plan and that stuff. So the radios are going the whole time.
Mm.
And sometimes you'll see the earpiece back and the guy will hold the earpiece to a player so we can have a direct conversation at the injury. Sometimes there's stuff coming back up to say that might be S&C based, that he reckons France has got another 3 or 4 minutes, he's cramping. So that's communication.
Right.
And then there's...
So there's quite a lot of communication happening.
And there's more sinister communication. What you're picking up from the opposition, what frequency we stumbled upon, or
there's a lot of subterfuge and.
Listen, you sweep.
It's a professional game, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't for a while, but I've been involved where we sweep the coach's box just to make sure there are no bugs. You know, the referees change room at halftime. That's an important place.
Mm.
I'm not saying we've done it, but because at halftime the referees are no doubt having a conversation. Watch Take is scrumming in or. All that sort of thing. So that's useful information if you can get it.
So you sweep the box.
I went for a while, but certainly can't stay in the last. Yeah, definitely sweep the coach's box.
That's unbelievable, huh?
Yeah, certainly away games because it's their facility. Captain's practice, you've seen the stuff. We don't do half the stuff we used to do at captain's practice on away games because we're just not sure who's watching. Yeah.
You see the South African coach now in the Rugby World Cup, he's got his lights. Any idea what those mean?
I don't. Look, it looked like last week they were saying go for poles. It looked like it was that simple.
Well, that's what the commentator said.
Yeah, it didn't look any more complex than that. But
yeah.
Seems like a complex solution to a fairly simple instruction.
Yeah, Nick Mallett's right. I mean, there's nothing you can't get on with the radio. You know, if we don't anymore with the Stormers, I'll tell you a funny story, but we don't put calls on anymore. I'll tell you right now. But there's no, you know, we used to, if it's a penalty, the guy or the tee just starts running. So you don't need a light for that or even a radio. Gareth, go. And then Marnie just knows to look at the side. He sees the tee's coming. But whatever it was, last year we played Genechli, Scarlets, and we were under the pump. And they were attacking us. And
in Cape Town?
Way away. And we needed to win with a bonus point to win the shield, South African shield. And Kitsie got a steal. And it was our penalty. And Warwick came up, took a quick tap, kicked it through to Marnie, and Marnie kicked it directly out. So it became their line-out even worse where we are. And I was, hey, jeepers, what? Lip is going, you go and tell Warwick if he ever does that again, he'll never play for the Stormers, did it? And I just lost it. And after the game afterwards, Warwick came up to me and said, you know what? We're going to go far. And I said, why? He said, because you trust us. I said, why? He said, well, I did that. Nobody said it. My radio was off. My radio was genuinely off. And the physios hadn't heard that. I actually learned a lesson, a genuinely good lesson.
Just by chance,
yeah.
If that message had got down to the physio and the doctor, he would have then relayed it to the player.
And we get crossed.
But not in the same language, potentially, that you had delivered it.
They would soften the language a little bit. They do that because they on the ground, they feel bad. Mm. But we watch them. How aggressive are they? They must be aggressive. Like, we got a physio we don't want to use because his field entry is poor.
Mm.
We want a physio who doesn't say, stuff the fourth official, stuff, go. Mm. You know what I mean?
Mm.
Our one doctor, you know, he's not getting on the field aggressively enough. It's a big thing that he can get on the field, go, doesn't matter the reprimand he gets. You know, that's an important part of it, actually.
Yeah.
We look at a physio's field entry.
Yeah, it's and even like the physio's relationship with the players and the degree to which they can be part of a squad without being part of the playing squad was a key factor. I remember in the teams I worked with, it's not their technical knowledge that matters. It's this other stuff.
That's fascinating because they're playing. You think the physio is there to look after the player's physio needs, but actually they're playing a much bigger role.
They are, but you see, they need a minimum standard of technical competency so that they don't screw up their core job.
Yes.
But then beyond that, the value add is the actual stuff. Right. It's not physio related or medical related.
No, they've got two other jobs. One is the technical, so they should know all our playbook, not our playbook where they go, but the jargon. You know, if we call a bozo, they must be able to say that. And then the other critical thing with them is they've got those guys for 3 times a week, 45 minutes one-on-one, which I don't get close to as a coach.
In a calm environment. Yes, relaxing massage time.
I know we've spoken to Gary.
100% right. We discovered players who had family issues, parental problems, marriage issues and stuff because the physio. But you see, the physio has to be so careful because you get one opportunity to violate that confidence.
100%.
And then you've lost it. So how does the physio know when to communicate, what to communicate? And the players know the game, and it's a whole delicate ecosystem that.
100%.
Yeah.
The physios are incredibly important like that. You're right. You can't break their trust. But they've got all the intel.
So now the physio knows that you've got a guy.
They're like almost
just
like the team moms in many respects. Yeah. People trust them, but they also play that role, the communication role.
Yeah. And they'll know everything.
Because you'll see a player or group of players are just not there. Their focus is wrong. The intensity's down. The one person knows about it, and it's the physio.
Mm.
Yeah. But if they tell you about it, they'll never know about it again. Yeah.
Mm. It's balancing it.
It's a very high EQ job.
How much do you play the referee? And when I say you, I don't mean you specifically. I'm also talking about generally the game. No, how much do you think the referees are played? In other words, do you research the referees?
Analyze
them. It's probably, you know, I don't do much. I do the breakdown, but a good portion of my weeks on the referee. So me and the analyst. Mm. So we've got a whole form. Which, what's his mindset? Is he a CEO? Is he a dictator? Is he
teacher?
A professor? Exactly.
Hmm.
How does he see the game? What does he want from the game? That's built up of a watching referee. Then, of course, there's a whole statistical support. You know, his attacking breakdown is beyond outside the, you know, he's on that side of the curve attacking breakdown-wise, so we have to be really careful with our entries or whatever the story. And then there's a third element, which is on the field, and that's where that's the old classic, good cop, bad cop. So this week, Kitsy's got to keep him in the tent, and Dion Varie, for example, got to put him under pressure with his head shake,
So you say keep him in the tent, and that'll be his pal.
Yeah, just say, listen, everything is okay.
Fine,
so Dion, Kitsy might say to Dion, shut up, Dion, leave Irk. He'll deal with it.
Mm.
But they completely know what they're talking, they know what's going on. But we also do the other level where if Ross is mic'd up, we'll go and get that, Kitsy will speak to the ref, knowing that it must get onto TV. So you say, listen, Marius, I'm taking around. Marius, the way they're scrumming in, surely you've got to have a look at that. But all we want is that to be broadcast. So the TMO, so the third official's got it.
Yeah.
So that's another thing. Half time, I'm not allowed to talk to the referee, which is right. But what we might do is get our captain to walk off down the tunnel next to the ref. So I'll be saying to Kitsy, tell him he's missed three holdings by them.
Mm.
I'm not speaking now, I'm speaking to Kitsy, but Kitsy's standing next to him as it comes down.
Because he can.
So information? No, it's a.
And you would have a strategy around the referee, the head of the game.
There's a document this thick about the referee. How are we going to manage him? How are we going to feed people?
Facebook stalking
under pressure. Everything, everything.
Is that a problem for rugby?
Yeah, because rugby shouldn't be that subjective, eh?
Yeah.
It is, but I mean,
but unless you have a computer on the field, you're going to have humans listen, doing
the,
it, aren't you?
The truth is, I mean, Ross won't disagree with me. Russie won us the Lions series by that diabolical video.
Mm.
It won us this. I've got no doubt if that video had come, we wouldn't have won that. That's impossible for a sport, isn't it?
Mm.
It'd be so subjective, eh?
Yeah, yeah. So talking about half times, you're famous for some of your best halftime speeches. Give us a bit of a précis of what kind of halftime discussions you have. Are they, I mean, obviously there are times when you're playing well, sometimes when you're playing badly. It's almost a mythical thing that people talk about, you know, what the player, what the coach said at halftime. What is your attitude towards the halftime talk? How does it work? In other words, you've got a certain amount of time. What happens as they enter that into the change room, and what are you doing?
A normal game. Mm. So they will give them 3 minutes of quiet, which is important for them to reflect, recover, you know, take, I try and keep it. It's hard, but you've got to try and keep the coaches away from them. Because the lineup coach wants to go to mine and say, listen, let's do this.
Yeah.
So that takes a bit of discipline. Then we'll go into a split. And then the forwards will gather around. These are the next few lineups. And nowadays we do show the odd clip. It's more forward-based. Darvey might have a picture of the backfield and kicking and for the backs. And then we'll come together. I'll let the defence guy say about 30 seconds. And then I will generally give a bit of a rev, just depending on what I think's needed. I'll tell you one which never works now. And then I'll leave with about a minute to go for Kitsy, because you must, the captain must, it shouldn't go me with them in a huddle, squeezing them straight on the field. I think they need to feel alone, safe together before they go on. So we give a minute or two to Kitsy or the captain.
Mm.
And I think that's pretty common across, I don't think it's too different from anybody else. I'll tell you, I say that the one that doesn't work is when we got the lead and I say, go out there and stamp on their throats and finish them. For some reason, I've never known that to work. That's not a call to arms enough for them. I think what they really need are sort of two or three technical levers. Mm-hmm. This is the restart plan from when we get out. We're receiving. This is what we're going to do. And this is what we need. This is technically what we... If we're playing poorly, then I'll go the old route. Yeah. And I'll say to the other coaches, okay, out the change room. I don't even get the chance to sit down and say, what the flip is going on? We asked you for these three things. Not one of you delivering this.
Mm.
How is it possible that so-and-so can break two tackles in the vacuum when we've said, scurry, you're covering the vacuum? This is a disgrace what's happening. These guys are paid 250, you know, the old school, 250 rand, and we're not one of them can afford. They've sacrificed something be here, and you're not prepared to sacrifice. And then I leave the change room, slam the door, and then the coaches come to the tidying up.
It's
almost planned, though.
I was going to say, it's not always a positive rep. Yes, you can do this, even though they're behind. It's kind of sometimes you have to do the crapping on, yeah.
The old school
crapping on,
Our players aren't as evolved as maybe some European players, I think. They come from a school system that's very hierarchical.
Mm.
Yeah, we try and I think people are trying to make the sense of safety, belonging, to lead from the back, to be player-driven.
Mm.
But our guys are conditioned for that boss or that headmaster mentality every now and again, you know. Unfortunately, they respond to that, you know, which is a pity.
Because how do you change it?
Yeah.
The thing you want to change it to is not working.
It reminds me of the conversation in the interview we did with Gary Kirsten when he was talking about coaching the Indian team. He says, I can't tell those guys how to be better players because they're already great. Is it the same? Do you think that happens to some extent at your level there? Once they get to the levels that you're coaching at, they have a certain level that they have just to be there. So you have to let them just get better at what they know they can get better at.
He's completely right.
Mm.
I mean, we our first almost thing, I was doing the breakdown, Scott Berger's flank. I mean, Dion Fury's the playing for us. He's the best. I can never teach Dion Fury to steal.
Can't tell him what to do.
Not enough. I mean, that's Gary Kirsten, who's averaged 50 or 40 for something in Test cricket. Yeah, and he's been there. I've never been close to being there. So, my thing's about trying to get them to challenge them to try and make themselves better in the right environment and have discussions about rugby and that. But there's no coaching element whatsoever.
Mm.
I think my job is to just make them feel safe. And that's important, you know, safe that there's a plan, that they're prepared well, they're physically, that they're rested. And to sort of discuss clips with them, you know. But I think that we're growing fast in that area in South Africa.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, my final question, and this is an interesting one because it talks to the players as well. When we look at top sportsmen, there are lots of egos at play. There are players with big egos and that sort of thing. How do you ground players? Because you get superstars that might be in a team and you might get personalities where you have strong personalities beyond the captain who might see themselves as leaders, especially older players. How do you keep a team grounded and kind of humble with each other, even when you've got great success? Or is it necessary to even do that?
No, it is. Some guys can do it and some guys can't do it. Some guys can be really good and fit, and there are lots that can't. So there's a thing, I think it's an old thing from Neanderthal days, or they used to call it shaming the meat. You know, so the hunter, when he goes out and gets the meat and brings it back to the kraal or the village, they would deliberately sort of humiliate him because he'd gone and got the kill and he knew all the... So in a funny way, we do this, you know, but like in a nice way.
Mm.
Humour, you know what I mean? And I think humour, like, I like humour by default. But just, you know, we have to, like I tell Marnie, listen, Marnie, you're flying with us, but your head's coming on DHL. You know what I mean? And we have to cargo that back to Cape Town. You know, we just try the team environment, try and create it's really a stratified team. And I don't want to name names, but you guys will know it. Some of the best things that happened to the Stormers in our case was certain guys leaving.
Mm.
Just because they were so big and they're not that bad people.
Mm.
You know, Sia, he's a guy I can name because he's a world-class captain and a world-class player and a world-class human being. And I love him. But he becomes so distraught. So we stop at the petrol station on the way up to Wilderness on Camp and bong him a number. We're just off the 2019 World Cup. We get off and people want selfies. That's great. And, you know, we're proud to have Bongi. And Peter Steff, World Player of the Year, get off. And a little bit more mob. Sia gets off. The people stop putting the petrol in. They just leave the petrol. The ladies in the shop are ululating. Mm. You know what I mean? So other players are sitting on the bus for 20 minutes.
Mm.
Waiting. And Sia's not going to say no to anybody.
Mm.
You know, so I'm not saying, I'm not trying to say promote Sia as having good, but in a team environment, actually probably wasn't a bad thing.
To keep him at a level where the players,
and that's very
he's
hard.
Not beyond, yeah.
So that's something I take a massive interest in. And the best way of doing it is to tease the guy. If you can get a little bit of relationship, a little bit of humour, and that he understands the need for, because once a team stratifies like that, once you've got a back of the bus culture, I think you're not going to win too much, you know.
Yeah.
That's something personally I obsess about. This thing, and it's not just, I mean, it's certainly not me, I'm getting from other people, this sense of belonging that everybody feels they've got a voice. Now, we've had a player who's going to leave or just left us. And I thought the other players wouldn't grow in his shadow because he was a great leader, competitive. He knew everything. He wanted to win everything. But it meant the next guys couldn't say, hang on, Ross, I want to try this move. Or hang on, Ross, I don't understand where to set on this move. You can't do that. So that is the key to keeping thing. Now everybody's got a voice and feels safe and then they belong. So I think,
because the game is a team game, essentially, individuals. Yeah.
Yeah. And if we can all contribute, I mean, and the same thing applies to diversity, you know. If diversity of opinion, if everybody's got a voice, you're definitely going to come up with more solutions.
Mm.
But because he's only played three games, or because he comes from Villiersdorp, he doesn't have a voice, which is ridiculous. You know, and that's
for sure. Yeah. Ross, any final questions from you?
No.
I mean, we could talk about this kind of stuff all day. It's fascinating just getting
good luck editing this shit.
No, we don't edit. We just run it. How do you see the World Cup playing out then? Last
game. You don't think I'm a Johnny come lately. That game in Mount Smart was South Africa winning the World Cup. That second half, where they got that slow ball, where they said, okay, you could see they stopped at halftime to say, we're not giving them fast ball. We're going in. So it's hard to see behind South Africa, France. Marks is the big thing, but we'll slow Ireland ball down.
Mm.
Ireland will have to kick. We've now got a proper X factor. Because the difference, you know, the Pollard and Amani Lubbock is, Pollard in backfield, and he's a great fluff, he's going to bomb it back. Marnie, if your chase isn't right, he's going to take it on, you know what I mean? So I think we add another bow to our game. We're probably discounting, 78% kick, goal kicker to 76, so one or 2 points a game? So it's us versus France. I don't see anybody else coming close. Australia better than we think. But I don't see the fast ball teams. I don't see Ireland or All Blacks being there. What do you think?
I'd be nervous about Ireland.
Okay.
I don't know. We'll see. I can see an unfortunate, unlucky thing changing the course of a game, such as the nature of rugby.
Yeah.
And then I can see injuries having a bigger influence than they should.
Well, I think this
might have already happened.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. Mark's thing is 10%.
Yeah.
Between now and the quarterfinal, all the big five will lose one more. So who's it going to be?
One more big player.
Yeah. Law of averages, right? You're going to lose one more. 100%. So the question would be, who do you lose versus New Zealand, versus Ireland, versus France, versus England? Can you absorb that loss? I think we're better placed to absorb it than most. But there's a point at which you can no longer do that.
I mean, I thought you could have done Eben as still a player. We could have got rid of it, replaced him easier than Malcolm Marx. Because your whole bomb squad now almost goes. Who's your bid?
I still think South Africa must be the favourites on paper. I mean, they've got the, just on recent form. But I'm not the expert. I'm just a fan, you know.
The winner
do you see a Springbok job in your future?
No. This is a... Look, I'm not.
Really?
I'll tell you something. Actually, factually, and I'm not being. I'm not good. I'm only good with my coaching team. I don't think you get that opportunity to take because it's high levels of trust with the coaches I work with. But this project to me is important, and we just done an equity. I wanted Stormers,
but the Stormers particularly.
This is the reconnection with Cape Town and a proper rugby team. We're a bit of built on sand at the moment. Yeah, you know, we've probably overachieved. Probably wasn't good for us in retrospect. You know, but now we've done an equity deal. What rugby means to this region is stratospheric, and that's where the Kirtleys and all those guys out there on the Cape Flats are. That's the project. You know what I mean?
That's the success.
It's good for rugby, and that's what I want to do.
Yeah, that's a success. Well, John, thanks very much for your time. It's been great having you today.
Yeah. Thanks, Ross.
Cool.
Thanks,
Ben.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.